Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name is Josh, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I travel around Orlando having conversations with entrepreneurs and founders and students and people who aspire to be an entrepreneur. And on the other side, those who invest in entrepreneurs and support the entrepreneurial community. Fun conversations that really spark a lot of interest and conversations within this community are people who have built businesses, sold businesses, and then got right back into the game. On today's show, we're going to have a conversation, and I'm actually in the studio of Greg Pollock in downtown Orlando and in his podcast studio, and we're just going to have an awesome conversation about his journey, the things that he's learned, and the advice that he has for you guys, the entrepreneurs. Greg, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for bringing me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so why don't, let me paint a quick picture of when I walked into your studio here, what I saw, and then we'll get into who you are and what you do. So ladies and gentlemen listening in, when I walked through the door, the first thing I saw were signs of encouragement, like you happiness is not something that happens by accident, but by choice. And then all these like positive words of affirmation and confirmation about choosing your destiny and the core values that make up Greg of who he is. So
what would you do today if you knew you could not fail?
Wow, what a great question. All right, so I want you guys to think about this. Close your eyes unless you're driving. What would you do right this minute today if you could not fail? So let's dive into this. Greg, who are you and what do you do?
Sure. Well, who am I? So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a father. I'm a teacher. I'm a traveler. But that pretty much sums me up. But what I'm really, one of the things I'm passionate about is being an inspiring teacher. And so what that means to me is taking really hard to learn topics and figuring out a way to explain them through video online so anyone can understand. And that's my art. That's my passion.
So the art of taking something that is complex and teaching it to people online. And from your past, and we'll get into this, you've impacted quite a few people teaching online. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Code School, at some point, we were up to maybe like 3 or 4 million accounts. So this was people on that were learning on my learning platform.
Got it. So why don't you take us back to, you know, maybe you going through school or the day you thought that one day you might be an entrepreneur. Take us back there.
That was definitely right out of college. So I was big into online gaming. I thought I wanted to be a game programmer, tried to be a game programmer, kind of failed at that. But I got my first job at 3DO, which was a company that the founder of EA created. Which had a console for a while, and I think they eventually folded. But I worked on the Army Men franchise, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
And while I was there, I was online gaming all the time, and there was competing in online tournaments. And some of the online tournament engines were kind of not that good. And I was like, I could build something better. So the first startup was just creating an engine for people to run their online tournaments. And I think I had maybe like 20,000 user accounts on that. But I didn't figure out how to monetize that one successfully. So I'd say that was the first failed startup, is trying to create a platform for people to run their own online tournaments. But the pinnacle of that, we had a booth at E3 that was like, I got my own booth at E3, and we're like selling this thing, but I don't think I got any sales. So, and you'll see that pattern over and over in my life, where I'll build something that was probably a great product, but I just didn't know how to do sales or marketing or have someone around me that could do sales or marketing. So that's usually where the failures led. But post that, I had to go get a real job. I went and worked as a data warehousing engineer at a old company called mp3.com in San Diego. And I had a computer at a college. I had a computer engineering major, theater minor.
Really?
I was definitely the only computer engineering major in the theater department.
Those are different parts of the brain, right? The arts and then the science.
Yeah, I always loved that. But yeah, you know, and bless my parents for when I came to them, like at the beginning of my junior year, and I'm going to my dad, who's a hardcore engineer. I'm like, Dad, would you be okay if I added a theater minor and it'd probably take me a little longer to finish school? And bless his heart for not going, Greg,
finish your programming thing. Like, don't do theater. But he was like, yeah, go ahead. Sure. Yeah. That's it. You're enjoying that? Okay, go ahead. And so I took some extra quarters in college. But, you know, I think I use it. I think I use what I learned in theater when I teach, which is fun. But back to the path. So went and worked for the man for a while and then got the bug again, moved to Orlando. And when we moved out here, I got a bug again. Like, hey, MP3.com, they had this amazing project management tool. I bet I could build that. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can take a couple months, see if I can build that. So I built up this amazing project management tool. Same story. Did not know how to do sales and marketing. Didn't get out there and sell it effectively. Didn't know how to sell it effectively. So eventually had to go get a real job again. And that time I did manage, though, to figure out how to do consulting work. So building people's websites. Because some of the, you know, read some business books and some books that were even programmer oriented that kind of showed you how to do consulting work effectively as a programmer. But yeah, should I keep on going?
No, well, I got some questions and I know the audience listening in. A few questions that popped into my head is, why did you choose Orlando?
The short answer is I have the bad habit of letting the women I meet move me about the country.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. So, but, you know, the longer answer is I met a woman in San Diego who was originally from Orlando, and we wanted to have kids, and it was expensive to buy a house in San Diego. And her family was in Orlando, and my parents grew up in Miami Beach, so they had moved back to Miami. We're like, okay, let's move back closer to family. And secretly, and I'm a little reluctant to admit this, I've always been a huge fan of Disney World and Walt Disney. So I was like, yeah, I want to bring up kids around here. I'm going to bring them to Disney World. Yeah, okay, that sounds great. So that's how I ended up in Orlando.
See,
about like 13 years ago.
Women and the mouse is what attracts me.
Women and the mouse. Yeah. Not necessarily at the same time.
Or in the same order. Something that you said is these patterns in your life, these patterns of I see a need, I build some amazing thing, I get some people doing it, but then it ultimately failed because you didn't really crack the code of monetization, right?
I didn't understand how to do sales. I just did not understand what it looks like to take. And what I tell entrepreneurs, because, you know, I started Studio, which is an accelerator, the first Orlando tech accelerator. And, you know, what I tell all the entrepreneurs there is really from day one, you need to be spending half your time doing sales and marketing. Only way you get around not doing that is by finding a friend who wants to be a co-founder who can spend 100% of the time doing sales and marketing. Then you can just work on the product. I just wanted to work on the product. I didn't understand how to do sales and marketing.
Yeah. So if you went back to when you were at 3DO, building Army Men, the game, which was a lot of fun. I remember actually, I think it was a game on the phone or computer.
It was on all the platforms, I think, at one point.
Very cool. And then you built that online gaming portal, right? Mm-hmm. So if you went back to then with the knowledge that you know now, what would you have done different?
That's a good question. I would have done more customer validation. Nobody ever does enough customer validation, right? So, you know, these days I tell entrepreneurs, like, before you write a line of code, especially developers, before you go out and build a product, go find, you know, 5 to 10 people or companies that have the problem you're trying to solve.
Yeah. And this isn't grandmother and mother validation. This is like customer validation. Yeah. Is there a difference in that?
Yeah, totally. Because you got to find the people that are going to be willing to buy the product, right? That have that problem. So you go to your potential new customers. People think, oh, well, they're not going to talk to me if I don't have a product, but that's complete crap, right? You're going to go to them. Okay, you do this business. Okay, can I take you to lunch? Can I get you coffee? I just want to learn more about your business. What do you love about what you do? What do you not like about what you do? What are some of the biggest problems you run into? Do you like the software that you're using that does XYZ? Okay, what's wrong with it? Okay, what do you like about it? Okay, if you had a piece of software that solved this problem more effectively, would you buy it? Oh, you would? Okay, how much would you pay for something like that? Oh, that much? Okay, great. Well, listen, you know, I'm working on a product right now that I'm building this out, and I'm looking for a few limited beta testers for this product. And if you commit to me that you guys are willing to try this out, then what I'm going to do is for the first year, I'm going to give it to you at like quarter of the cost that everybody else is going to get it. Notice here, I'm not offering it for free. This is a mistake that lots of entrepreneurs make.
Yeah.
Never offer it for free. You don't have to. You can take 90% off, but they still have to pay something or they won't value it, right? You're never going to get them to pay for it if they're used to it being free. So you get the, you get 25% off, and then you sell them something, and then you bring it to them every step of the way. Not when you finish it at the end, right? You create some screens, and you bring it to them and say, hey, does this make sense? And then you go back and revise on their feedback and then bring it to them again. And hopefully you build something that they would use and pay for.
Yeah. So if you're listening in and you've heard this, like that pitch that he just did over lunch with a potential client, not mom and dad or some uncle who you're seeing if they like your idea or not, but a potential client, go back and listen to that over again right before your client meeting, because those are like a phenomenal script, great questions that to ask, and you might walk away with a client in mm-hmm. the pipeline.
Yeah, customer validation is just another word for sales.
Yeah,
it really is. Early if you sales, do it right, yeah, it's early sales.
Yeah,
but really, you're also making sure that you're building the right thing, because when you ask them before you lead them down the road and tell them what you're building, when you ask them what are your three biggest problems in your business, you better be praying that one of those three problems is the one that you're trying to solve. Because if it's not, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Right? If it turns out that problem is maybe the 10th one on their list, then you might want to rethink what you're building or interview a couple more people to validate that it's indeed maybe not as important as you thought.
Yeah. And it might save you decades of building something that nobody wants or will pay for, right?
Yeah, which I've done.
All right. So the Army Man Online Gaming, we went into building this project management tool, and you didn't do early sales, early customer validation, which you saw this pattern in your life. I built something that I thought was cool. Nobody bought it, right? And how did you break that pattern in your life? Because that's probably expensive. Pattern?
Yeah, it's interesting. I probably broke that. It sounds weird. I probably broke that pattern by just following my passion. Really?
Wow. Okay. This is all right. So let's talk about that, because a lot of people say, don't chase your passion. You need to chase profits, or you need to, validate this and that. Like you actually cracked your pattern by chasing your passion. Let's talk about that. Let's unfold this.
Yeah, well, sure. You know, it's funny. We talked about earlier, I went to the Tony Robbins Date with Destiny event back in December. And one of the things that he helps you figure out is what is the old, can I swear on here? Is that okay?
Yeah, go for it.
What is the old shitty question that you're constantly asking yourself? We all have one question, and it usually goes really deep. I'm deep into psychology, which you'll find out. It goes back to which parent of yours did you want love from more?
Ooh.
And how did you convince yourself that you could get that? And that's what you go looking for in the world. So for me, that was, having a father who was big into competence and being smart and being correct, and he would correct you if you were wrong. What I got in my head was, I need to make sure everybody thinks I'm smart. How do I make sure everybody thinks I'm smart?
Right.
And that old shitty question works for you and against you. And sometimes it leads you to your passion. And so what I ended up doing is I ended up, I really enjoyed, I realized I started a blog back, I was doing consulting work, and a friend said, hey, let's start a blog together. We started a blog, and I would write up a blog post. I would take, and now here's another lesson that I always tell people. I would take 50% of my time writing it and 50% of my time promoting it. Mm. Most people just write and just put it up there.
And they just throw it out there.
If they read it, they will come, right? Yeah. Whatever. If I post it, they will come. But you got to do more than that. You got to do self-promotion. I would do that. And man, I got people coming out of the woodwork saying, Greg, this is great. You explained this really well. Which I heard was, oh my gosh, you're so smart. Right? All these people came and said, you're great. I never understood this. And now I understood this. And I was like, this is amazing. People think I'm smart. All these people are telling me I'm loving this. So it really motivated me to do more of it. And I think that was partially fueled by just this idea that I got up the impression as a kid that I wasn't very smart. And then also, I remember asking my dad. My dad did, he was an engineer at Intel. And I remember asking him, like, can you explain to me what you do, Dad? And him going, it's too complex. You wouldn't get it. And I was like,
wow. How old were you when you asked that question to your dad?
Oh, I probably did it a few times over the years. Yeah. I wanted to understand, you know, I reached out like, let me explain to me. I'm curious. Right. And he just didn't take the time. So that kind of gave me the impression maybe I'm not very smart. So what did I, if somebody asked me, what do you think you do like better than most people in the world? What would I say? Explain stuff.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that comes from that. So,
sometimes there's great things that come out of pain in our lives, right? We create great things out of pains, right?
Well, it's really those biggest struggles. The biggest struggles of your life are really sometimes where your greatest victories and greatest passions come from. Your greatest compassion comes from. Because if you were abandoned, if you were abused, if you were rejected, if you were cast out, then you have a tremendous amount of compassion for people who are facing that same adversity. And if you can channel that power into contribution and giving back, it'll give your life meaning. And so one thing that Tony says that I really like is, what if your worst day was actually your best day?
Reframing that situation and what you thought that whole time was a curse, it might have actually been a blessing.
Right. There's a lesson there. There's something there that is going to cause you to drive you to create good in the world, because that happened to you. You have a tremendous amount of compassion for people going through the same thing. So if you can embrace that, figure out how to use it, then you'll find passion. So back to I figured out that, wow, I can post a blog post and I'm pretty good at this and I got a lot of validation. And I started doing more blog posts, and then I started doing podcasting, and then I started speaking at conferences and explaining things. And I would put a lot of effort into these talks, and I go give them at conferences. And I'm like, dude, I can't just put all this work into conferences and not do more with it. So I would tape myself, you know, giving these talks, and I put them online. And the nice effect of that is it really built my personal brand.
Yeah.
And it kind of created a brand around that I'm a domain expert in that particular technology, because it was one technology that I was talking about. And that had the nice side effect of generating leads. And so that generated leads for my consultancy and started building the consultancy from there.
Wow. Which came first, the chicken or the egg on this? Did you start, so you started blogging and you started speaking, or did you start the consultancy first?
I started doing consulting stuff, just me. And that came from putting up a website and going to 4 or 5 business networking groups all over Orlando, shaking hands and meeting
people.
My
name's
people.
Greg, and I do consulting, right?
Yeah, and I build websites, and you know, not just regular websites, but like web applications. And like my first client was like a local organization that needed a way for people to sign in and administrate their accounts and whatnot. So
which worked better? Going to these networking meetings, hey, I'm Greg, I do consulting, and I build websites and web applications, or the teaching, the blog posting, the online, you know, coaching, and then the seminar, like which do you think produced more fruit for your consultancy?
It depends on what kind of consultancy you want to be. My opinion is that if you want to build a successful local consultancy, like here in Orlando, and get big clients, you're probably best going to the networking groups, because you gotta get your face in front of people. If you're going to be selling them $50,000, $100,000 web applications that they build, you need to get in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so that means going to these meetings, joining like the chambers of commerce, going to the other successful businesses, making sure they're taken care of, and just making friends and shaking hands. That's more effective, I think, when it comes to bigger sales, because you're going to have to get in front of people no matter what. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting to me to see like even the global like web services that are out there, as soon as they reach a certain price point, I think it's something like as soon as you pass like $500 a month, you're better off taking your price off your website and saying, contact us.
Yeah.
Right. So they can get a salesperson to talk to you.
People buy from people.
Right. Exactly.
Wow.
And so if your price point's lower and you're doing something more passive, like say online learning, which I got into, then you have to have the lead gen to deliver tons of people to your website.
So do you think that your time in theater and studying that actually helped you on stage and presenting?
Oh, yeah.
Sales? Give us a piece of nugget, right? So those who didn't go to that kind of training, like give us some golden nuggets that you learned from theater that could be applied to business?
Some golden nuggets. Well, when I go on, one thing that I do when I go on stage and I'm teaching, because I do a lot of that, I'll go in front of people. And this could be when you're doing a business presentation, is whatever I think is going to be over the top. Like, I go into it going, okay, I'm going to go in there, give 150%. That means being animated. That means being fun. That means being full of energy. And in my mind, I'm going to feel silly. And I know I'm going to feel silly because I'm giving 150%, right? But in reality, to everybody else, it's just going to be entertaining and it's going to be engaging. But to me, I'm going to feel silly doing it. So just embrace the silly.
Embrace the silly. I like it. All right. So you're up on stage. Do you ever get nervous, like speaking in front of people? Have you ever spoken to like a huge group of people?
Oh, yeah. All the time. Yeah.
How do you get over that nervousness? Because, I mean, one of your side of your brain is the scientific, the coder, the complex, right? That might be screaming standing in front of a group of people, you know, for maybe some developers out there who don't have the theatric side of their brain. Like, how do you overcome that? Or how do you get past that nervousness?
Just do it a lot. Everything is hard until it's easy. But there's ways to get around that. There are, what is the name of the group? I never did one, but the
Toastmasters.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. If you need to be doing sales, you know, you'd be doing sales and you're kind of shy in front of people. Toastmasters is brilliant for that. Also, you know, you can take an acting class. I mean, even here locally, I took a improv at SAC down here.
Yeah.
Which, oh my God, it's like, yeah, as somebody who's more controlled than he wants to be and who analyzes what he says more than he wants to, doing improv is really awful. It's hard and it's stressful and, oh my God, get out of your comfort zone. It felt like awful, not good therapy, like bad therapy. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this is super risky right now. Could you take maybe 2 minutes and maybe walk us through an exercise of improv or something like that? So like take me out of my comfort zone and let's do something that you think might be helpful to the audience to learn, entrepreneurs out there who need to pitch in front of people.
No, I got nothing.
Okay. God, all right.
I appreciate you asking, but
yeah.
If it comes to me, I'll let you know.
All right. Sounds good. We might revisit this. So Greg, from building your consultancy, you built something that was, it started growing, you started getting more and more clients, and you found that you really had a passion of taking that what is complex and teaching that through people. Now, you built a business called Code School. Mm-hmm. You helped build this out. How did you get that thing off the ground? How did you start that? Because it impacted millions and millions of people.
Right. So it starts with the consultancy because I was able to build a consultancy because of the personal brand that I did. So it was the teaching at conferences. It was the blog posts. It was the podcast that led people to the website, which led people to, hey, also we create web apps. Get in touch if you need web apps. And we started with two people and then three people. And what I would do is to grow it is I'd have a big client that would come in, like potential big client. And maybe it was going to be like 4 or 5 months of work. And I would, you know, I would make it look like it was going to, at that point, it looked like it was going to happen. I would then reach out to developers I knew in the community, which is another part of it is like, I was deep into the tech community, right? And so I started the Ruby users group, and that was the technology that we were using was Ruby. So I knew of all the most talented developers in town. So I'd give like one of the developers a call, say, hey, dude, I know we're creating a startup. It's a little risky. We're doing a consulting project, but I've got a guaranteed 4 months of work for you if you want to join. And here's the project and come on board. And that's how I would build it up. So we got up to about 20 people and every 3 or 4, you know, I would still go and speak at conferences and every 3 or 4 months, I would take the time to really put together fill a void in the community. I would look and see what educational content in this technology community is missing. What can I create for free that would help all the developers and build our brand? So I would fill that void and then that would become a popular place because it was all just free stuff. And then that led to more consulting work. And Code School was just figuring out how to monetize that free stuff we were putting out. right? And, you know, was we put out a product called Rails for Zombies, which was a intro to Ruby on Rails that combined the video that I love to produce with interactivity, like coding in the browser. So you would watch 5 minutes and then you'd prove that you understood it by coding right there. And like, it's kind of like a quiz, but you were really solving problems using code in the browser. You don't have to install anything. It was very gamified. So you got points for everything. You earn badges when you get to the end. And people loved that so much, right? And that was just another, this Rails for Zombies was just another free course that we put out there for the community. But we knew we were onto something because we put that out there and people just loved it and people just loved the crap out of it. And it was around that time that I got a call from one of the biggest tech book publishers. It was O'Reilly Publishing. And I knew some people from the conference because they also run conferences, but I knew some people who worked there. And they gave me a call around that time and they said, "Greg, we don't get in one conversation where we talk about the future of publishing where Rails for Zombies doesn't come up in the conversation. We've got to figure out how to work together or at least pay you to create more of these. Can we like co-brand it? What can we do?" And we're like, "Wow. Okay. There must be some value here. Like people are trying to help us to get, okay." And so we ended up saying okay, we need to do this again and this time charge for it. And that was really what Code School started out, was just like, let's create another online course and this time try to charge for it. And maybe we'll create a platform like Steam where it feels like there's different games, but really there are other courses. And what would that look like? And go from there. So we were able to, long story short, we bootstrapped really the Code School out of the consultancy, right? So that's why we didn't need to raise money, is because the consultancy was making money. And I had spent 5 years building brand. And I had spent the last 5 years up until that point creating online learning. So we had a pretty good brand even when we launched our first paid course. So much so that we probably put in probably about $20,000 into the course. And then within 2 months, into the first course, and then within 2 months we would have 40. And then we just repeated that over and over again until we had enough content. And then we went to the recurring revenue model and sort of built that into I think we were making about $6 million in recurring revenue when we were acquired by Pluralsight for $36 million.
Now, that is, that's awesome. That's really amazing. Like the amount of money that's coming in and in recurring revenue is so powerful, and especially for an acquisition for someone looking for that. Talk to us about the pivot and maybe the different business models, because you had one which was, here's our product, go buy it. You don't like it? Okay, cool. Versus the recurring revenue. Like what inspired you to move towards, you know, the recurring revenue?
Because you have to.
No. That's a great answer.
I think around that time, Eric Allam, who was one of the co-founders with me, just helping, really encouraged me to build it into a business. He really encouraged us to go towards recurring revenue. He was smart enough to know that, like, okay, we can sell these courses one-off, or we can do the recurring revenue model, because inevitably that's just how you get more, how you become more profitable. Once you have enough content, you get recurring revenue, people get a monthly subscription. And the way that we worked, it was crazy, because we were charging like $35 a course. So people could buy each course individually for like $35 or $40, or for like $24 a month, they can get access to everything. Yeah. And when you put those two prices right next to each other, you're kind of using a little bit of psychology where people look and they go, okay, $40 to buy this course forever, or $24 a month to get access to this course and all the rest. I'm going to do that. I think we were doing some interesting price comparison there, which if you're interested in learning about price and the psychology of price and how to price things, I'm a big fan of Predictably Irrational, which is the book by Dan Ariely,
yep,
where he goes into the psychology of that and how important it is to have comparison. And when you're going into a new market and you have one price and you can't compare it to anything, people have a hard time buying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great book.
Hey, you read it?
Oh, yeah. It's such a good book because, you know, it talks about the power of options, price pegging, and if, you know, people most likely will choose the thing in the middle, and you could even, I mean, there's been thousands of experiments that have been run on price testing, but it's so powerful to show them the value. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have $40 one course, or man, check out this value. Yeah. We don't do this for everyone.
What was it in this book? Was it the bread maker at Williams and Sonoma or something like that? I think there's an example in there. Or was it an ice cream maker or something?
I don't remember.
So I think it was a bread maker. So it's like, I think it was like, Williams. Can you picture it? You can picture it, like Williams Sonoma up on their website. They have the bread maker and it's there. It's premium bread maker for like $2.99. And no one's buying it until they put up on the website the like luxury premium bread maker, which is $450. Now, all of a sudden, the $300 bread maker is just selling like crazy because people have something to compare it to. They don't know how much it's worth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen companies do this where they had, you know, two options. They had the bronze and silver option, and then they just created this gold option, and they're like, heck, we don't even have a gold option, but if someone spends, you know, call us in for pricing. I've seen that where people will like just create this, like, if someone pays this, we will create it for them kind of model.
And it, what that's a it good did, idea.
Yeah, it created a lot of people buying it, those middle and lower tier things. So yeah, it was we ran some experiments, and you know, this show's not about me or this, but like this is so powerful of what you did. So talk to us about, as you're building this, people started coming to you and saying, hey, are you interested in buying? Or I mean, selling your company, are you interested in, you know, that? What does that even look like? Because your head's down building, you're building your brand, you're building a business, you're building a team of over 50 people. You're like, you're building this, and now people are coming to you saying, do you want to sell this?
Yeah.
What's that like?
Well, okay, so that's different than what happened at the end, but, but that does happen. It doesn't, when you start to have conversations, and I would always make sure that when I was going out to the big cities for conferences, whether it was San Francisco or New York, this is the thing you got to do. You always got to make sure that you're making friends with everybody else in your industry, right? So if I'm going out to San Francisco, I'm looking at who else here is successful in the online teaching space, even if they're slightly different. And how can, and I want to invite them all to lunch, right? So you got to create these relationships. And then what you end up usually talking about is how can we cross promote, right? How can we make sure, you know, that you advertise us, we advertise you, and everybody wins, right? So you start creating these relationships, which are so important, that'll hopefully at least end with some sort of cross promotion. But inevitably, if you do make friends, you'll start having those conversations where they'll start to go, you know, if you ever want to like have some merge together, we might be able to create a competitive product together. And that stuff can get really attractive, especially if, like, for example, you're really into building product and they have built out a 50-person sales team, which is not in your wheelhouse. All of a sudden, it might make sense to be like, oh, wow, okay, so our weakness is your strength and your strength is our weakness. We could be an even better company if we combine forces. That's why it's important to sort of make friends. And then, you know, I think it was the same connections when we decided to entertain the idea of an acquisition. So how that came about is, you know, we were lucky enough because we bootstrapped it out of the consultancy that we didn't have to take any money. Didn't take any money at all. Which was also really nice, is that I was able to give away a lot of the company. So anybody, at the end, I own less than 50% of the company because it made sense to me that just people who are giving their blood, sweat, and tears into the company deserve equity. So anybody who was there longer than a year had a good chunk of equity, more than they would probably from most tech companies in Silicon Valley. And that just feels good. So we got to this point where we realized we were at a pivot. The same team that got us to like 5 or 6 million in revenue, it's probably different than the team that was going to get us from like 5 or 6 to 50 if we wanted to keep on scaling the company. And when you have a good recipe, you know, you kind of want to use it. It makes sense. If you got a recipe and it works and you see some success, like maybe you should double down. If you don't, someone else is going to. So it was at that point that we started entertaining, okay, do we raise intelligent money? So we went to like investors who we knew maybe they will put some money in. Maybe we take some money off the table at that point, which is smart when you're making like between 2 and 5 million. And if you can get investors that bring in that allow you to maybe they'll invest, you know, 10 million into the company, and you can take 5 million and put it in everyone's bank accounts, right? Just to like de-risk a little bit. It's smart to do that if you can. And then take the other $5 million and use it with the investors who hopefully can bring in the right people to scale. Because none of us had the background. We didn't know. No one came from a company that scaled from 50 to, you know, from 5 million to 50 million before. So we realized, okay, we should either maybe raise some investment, take some money off the table, and find investors that can help us build the expertise we need. But then I got some good advice from a local I was in a CEO roundtable, which is also really important to get into once your company is a certain size. And some of the advice I got from there was the best time to potentially entertain a merger or acquisition is right before you take any investment. Because the moment you take someone's money, you're promising them. So if you gave me $1 million to invest in my business,
done.
I have to promise you that I'm going to give you back 10 million.
Yeah.
I have to be confident that I can promise you that I'm going to take your 1 million and be confident that I'm going to give you back 10. And if I'm not confident, I shouldn't be taking your money. But what that means is the valuation that you as an investor want me to get to is pretty high. And so if I take your money and then I'm like, hey, I want to entertain this acquisition, and you're going to get like $1 million and $1,000 back because that's our valuation as you made our valuation, right? And you were happy with it and you're not going to be happy with that. So you're not going to be able to, you're not going to agree to that merger acquisition. So we entertained that. And so, you know, that was a fun process of just thinking, okay, if we entertain the idea of a merger acquisition now, who are the companies we want to work for? Who are the companies that have what we don't? Who are the companies that have strengths where we have weaknesses that really could amplify our product? Because like what we're passionate about is creating the most effective way for people to learn and start learning a technology. And we're in front of, you know, 3 million people now, but how do we get to 30 million people, right? How do we grow and do that? And do we have the right team? And is there a company out there that already has an extra 10 million developers as an audience that they can market to? Because really, you know, and even like, you know, just like core altruistically, like very much like I love creating online content, helping people. That fucking drives me, right? And if teaming up with another company that can get my teachings in front of 10 million people and make that much more of an impact on the world, that's awesome. That's really gratifying. And so you got to look at that too. So we talked to a bunch of companies that we thought we'd want to work with, and we did the dating game. That's what you kind of do. Like you fly to their company and see how they make the pizza. And then they fly to your company and see how you make the pizza, which is also really validating. You kind of just show them, they spend a day with you, and this is how we do this. This is how we do this. And it was so funny when this happened, because the people who'd fly in, they were much more experienced than us about running businesses. And at the end of the day, they would turn to me, Greg, you really got a great team here, and the way you do business is amazing, and blah, blah, blah. And then they'd leave the room, and I would turn to the rest of my team and go, holy shit, guys. Maybe we actually do know what we're doing here. Whew. Yeah, because you're just like, because I'm constantly just like, is this work? Is this right? Still trying to figure stuff out.
It's good validation, huh?
Oh, it was, yeah. So like, even if it wouldn't have worked out, it still would have been great. We still learned so much, not only from that validation, but by getting a managerial perspective on these other similar businesses,
yeah,
to see what was working, to see what didn't working. It was like a MBA in like 3 months.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It was great.
What, as you were building this, I mean, very successful business and doing that, like what was one of your biggest mistakes? Something that you look back and go, that was probably the biggest mistake I made in this. Maybe I gained a lot of wisdom from it, but like that was,
yep,
that was dumb.
Yeah. So one thing we haven't really touched on yet, although you kind of, with all the inspirational stuff and the stuff you saw on the right end of here, I'm really passionate about creating spaces for people to get out of their heads and their hearts.
Okay.
All right.
Explain that.
And so what I mean by that is, you know, people call it company culture, but a simpler way to say it is get out of your heads and in your hearts, because as humans, we're built for survival. Like in our brains and our minds are always like, is this going to be okay? Am I going to get the paycheck? Am I going to get in trouble? Am I going to get fired? Is this person trying to steal my cheese? What should I do? Right? That's the thinking brain. That's the survival brain. But our hearts want to create. They want to play. They want to follow our passion. They want to contribute, right? So the best thing that I can do to create a company culture is to create an atmosphere where people feel safe, where people feel like they can be themselves, where people feel like they can be open and make friends, and they're not worried about their cheese. So they can just focus on following their hearts and not their minds. So I'm really, really passionate about that. Okay, but hold on. I've lost my train of thought. What was your question?
The question was, what was your biggest screw up? What was the dumbest thing?
I'm getting there. So okay. That was just a premise. So I care a lot about creating a space where people can do their best creative work.
Yeah.
And probably what I underestimated was how demoralizing it was going to be when we had to do a round of layoffs. So basically what happened was, it was early days of Code School. Consulting company was working alongside Code School. We probably had 10 people working on Code School maybe, and like 20 people working in the consultancy. And all at once on the consulting side, like three clients like wound down at the same time. Mm. Like without it, we weren't expecting it. And I was focused on Code School. There was other people on the team that were trying to take the lead on the consulting work because they were like, Greg's passionate about this. Let's let him do this, which I'm thankful for. But they just weren't able. The weeks went by and we're like, okay, we've got a month to really drum up more work or we're going to have to do layoffs. A month went by and we didn't find him. We were just losing money. So we had to do a round of layoffs. And and I did not realize how demoralizing that was going to be for the team. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like it was good because I feel like maybe some of the hires that we did weren't the best hires. And that was kind of an opportunity to really strengthen our core team. But I didn't realize how much it was going to demoralize people, no matter how transparent we were with like, this is awful. We don't like doing this. We're sorry. This is surprising. We're safe now. Like in doing this, we're safe. In doing this, we are, you know, good for the future. No matter what we would say, nothing would really forgive the amount of trust that you could just feel in the air that we lost, that I lost. And I felt like Alexander Hamilton. Are you familiar with Alexander Hamilton?
I mean, I've heard of the guy in history, the inventor. And am I way off? Am I right? No, I feel like an idiot.
The $10 founding father.
Okay.
Without a father. President.
All right. So tell us that story.
I just saw the show on Saturday. So one of the things that Alexander was like brilliant at was he's just a brilliant writer, right? And like the Federalist Papers, like he wrote most of them. He really doesn't get as much credit as he deserves. And it's because, part of it is because he was the first like politician that publicly got shamed for having an affair.
Okay.
It was the first, like first time politics like that got called out, that he got called out by his enemies that, you know, basically said that he's, you know, he's corrupt and he's immoral and look what he did, right? Because they found out that he was basically like paying this guy's husband so that he could sleep with his wife. It was just, yeah, it was weird. It was not good, right? Didn't look good.
Yeah.
I know, he, you know, I'm sure he didn't feel good about it either. But why I felt like him, right, is that what he had always written, like written was his method. He thought he probably could solve anything by just get enough people by writing. And so he thought, oh, well, I'm gonna just write everything that I did and show people that, yeah, this, I'm not proud of this. This is what I did. And this, you know, I didn't use government funds for this. And I'm not proud of it. And he's like, I can write my way out of this. He thought he could write his way out of it.
Yeah.
And so he produced a pamphlet. What was it called? The Reynolds paper, I think. And he just, because his enemies were kind of threatening him with this information. And he's like, I'm just going to publicly put it out there, right?
Yeah.
But of course, that did not help him at all, right? So in the long run, that was probably a bad move for him to do because it just showed everybody. It just solidified everybody's fears about him and whatnot. He thought he could write his way out. And it was in this moment, looking back at those days, where I realized I had lost the trust. It was one evening and I was hearing from secondhand from people at the company about how people were demoralized and maybe some people were looking for other jobs. And I was like, okay, I'm going to write something up. And I just wrote my fucking heart out. I just wrote, you know, this is what we did. This is what we did. And I feel so bad and I feel awful. And I sent it to my I sent it to the co-founders, the leadership team of the company. Say, like, here, I'm thinking I want to send this out to everybody. And they were like, no, you don't get to send that. And I was like, what? But this is like vulnerable. And this is, and they were like, no. And I was like, shit. And I felt powerless. But I think they were right. I think at some point, you know, you just can't write your way out of, no matter how vulnerable you are, no matter how much you bare your soul, there's some situations that you just can't write your way out of. You just have to build trust by your behavior, not what you say.
Yeah. Wow. What a powerful lesson, man. And my third grade history teacher would be so pissed that I didn't know Alexander Hamilton. So I'm sorry, Ms. Stewart. I remember your name, but I don't remember a freaking president. All right. Anyways. So.
Okay. I'm going to go on a tangent just because I want to bridge some more. So what I was talking about earlier, getting out of the heads and into your hearts.
Yeah.
Recently, I've been realizing like, holy shit, there's so much to be said for that. And that's what I was doing. And I was helping people with their company, getting out of their heads and into their hearts. And one question I tell, you know, people that now have a team of like 5 people, 10 people, 15 people, when they start to ask, how do I create a good culture? And I tell them, just assume that you're always getting in the way of your most talented people doing their best work. Just assume you're always getting in the way and constantly try to get out of the way. Because odds are there's things you can do to motivate people and to bring out the creative parts of them that you're not doing. And so that, you know, all that's really doing is helping. So these little things, it's all about helping people get out of their heads and into their heart, because we all want to create. And if you can empower people to create and empower people to just pour themselves out into the work and to go to bed at night just empty because they've poured themselves out into it, like that's how you end up with a passionate team that does amazing work. And when I think about, like, this is a big leap, but bear with me. When I think about how cool it must have been to be at the start of our nation, right? Of these rebels that were fighting against the British monarchy because they had a vision to create this, you know, republic, this democratic republic where people could feel safe, where people could believe what they wanted to believe, where people could be free. What is that really? Oh man, is that also this idea of helping people get out of their heads, feel safe, so they can follow their passions and their dreams. Oh, wow. See that there too. Not happy with the current state of politics, but back then it must have been awesome.
Wow. You mentioned getting out of the way of your team. You've mentioned founders, co-founders, right? If you're a technical founder, you need to devote half your time to selling or find someone, a partner who can do it full time. You talk about getting out of the way of your team. How do you know what you should focus on and what you should get other people to help you with?
Well, in the beginning, you got to be willing to do all of it.
Yeah.
Right? If you're an entrepreneur, you have to kind of resign yourself to like, okay, it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm launching this thing tomorrow. I don't know how to do email marketing, but I'm going to read a few tutorials and just do it. Yeah. You gotta have the attitude. Yeah. And it's funny because, I have a few friends that are like, you know, super successful entrepreneurs, and they try to go back and create other companies, and they're like, I got this company, created this company. I got this guy in charge of this, this guy in charge of this. And so often they fail. And it's because they need heroes, right? You've got to have that one person working for the company that believes in it so much that he's going to put his kids to bed and get back to work because that's how much he's in it or she's in it. Just to go above and beyond and not willing to, you know, not sort of like, I'm just going to do my part. I'm just good at this, so I'm going to do that. Like that don't work. You have to be willing to wear all the hats. And so you got to wear all the hats until you can afford not to, really, or until you raise some money and then figure out where you need the domain experts. But man, even in the beginning, like the first 5 people, you also got to find people who are willing to wear multiple hats.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You just have to. If you find somebody that's like, no, man, I only want to do social media. That's my thing. And you're just like, no, nope, that's not going to work. I got to find somebody who's just like, is excited to work for a smaller company because they can see growth and they can build the growth with their own two hands. Yeah. So I could probably take this in two directions. There's two things I usually talk about.
All right.
One direction would be talking about dynamic equity and how to do equity right.
Okay.
And the other direction is how to start building your online audience.
All right. So I got two options in front of me. One, we could talk about dynamic equity.
Yeah.
Right. And then the other way we could talk about how to build an online audience. So,
or we can do both.
Or you could do both. So let's do this. Let's move into and segue into what are you doing now? and then let's pair on the option number two.
Yeah.
Is how are you building? Because I'm looking right now at a counter.
Yep.
1378. So I'm looking at a counter. He has this automatic counter, like a ticker, you know, thing that every time a new subscriber goes onto his platform, it clicks on another one. It clicks on another one. It clicks on another one. Right. And as we're sitting
here, I have a love hate relationship with that thing.
you could hear it in the background moving. But why don't we talk about that second option and what you're doing now? And how did you build that audience? Because you're building a whole new set of people.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good segue because I had to sort of eat my own dog food there. So what I'm really good at is figuring out how to get in front of an audience where they're at. Like, I love that stuff. So we kind of did two things at the same time to start building our new audience. Well, first of all, we had to pick a technology. We wanted to teach a technology that wasn't already in the mainstream, that needed good educational content. So we looked at a lot of analytics. We looked at a lot of data. How many followers do they have? How much people are following them in GitHub? We identified a bunch of factors, and we narrowed down to one technology called Vue.js, which is in the early adopter phase, but at the time at least, it hadn't yet made it into mainstream. Whether it is or not right now is questionable. And so we started building audience. How did we do that? Well, we started writing blog posts and posting social media. And of course, you need a lead gen generator. So we learned the technology. We created a cheat sheet. You know, a lot of people do a two-page PDF cheat sheet that has all the syntax you need. Work with a designer to make it look real pretty. It's the prettiest cheat sheet out there for review. And then created some landing pages, right? Same like you do. So create the landing pages, and then all your blog posts drives for people, you know, downloading the cheat sheet. And then at the same time, I really like creating, you know, high quality explainer videos. So we went and we talked to the guys that run Vue.js, the project itself. And we said, hey guys, if you're interested, we'd love to create for you a free video that you can put on the front page. I know you don't have a video on the front page that really explains visually why people should use Vue and why it's interesting. And we'll work with you to do it. Are you interested? And they were like, sure. Yeah. Okay. And we have multiple steps. Like, we put together an outline and got them to revise it. And we put together a script and we got them to revise it. And then we put together a rough draft video and we got them to get feedback. And then eventually, so now when you go to Vue.js.org, there's a big button that says, you know, why Vue? And when you click that, it's a video from us. And of course, you know, at the time back then, we're like, you know, also you can download our cheat sheet over here. And so it's driving people as a lead gen. And these days we've got free courses. So really what it says on our video, at the end of it is like, do you want to try our free course? Click here. And they get driven there. So that's just an example of getting in front of your customers where they are and providing value to the people who are, you know, who are on there. So they can find your lead gen. So that's Vue Mastery. So we did that. And then we started building out courses. And once we had a paid course, we put out, people could pay $19 a month to get access to all of our courses. We put out one lesson a week. Oh, and what's really kind of unique about it, and what gets me really excited, is the give back, is the contribution portion of it. So, you know, are you familiar with what open source technology is?
Yes.
Okay. We'll assume your audience does too. So open source, a lot of time these are developers that are not making any money off it. They just put it up there for the good of the community. If they're not sponsored by a big corporation like Facebook or Google, the people who work on it are need the support of the community. They need sponsors or Patreons to be patrons. That's the word. They need patrons on Patreon to be successful. And so, what I wanted to do from the get-go was take 25% of revenue, not profit.
Of revenue.
25% of revenue. Top line. We donate back to the project. And so it's this huge give back. And what's exciting about that is we might be, I should find out for sure. But up until this point, we might be like the biggest supporter of the technology now. And if we're the biggest supporter of the technology now and we keep on growing at this pace, we'll be the biggest supporter of this technology forever. Which is really exciting to me to just be able to contribute back, to have that do open source and support it in such a huge way. And it's a really symbiotic relationship, which is just rad. So that's really worked out well.
All right. So to give people an idea of how you built the audience,
yeah,
you went to the people who created the technology that, yeah, that you want to, so you teach the world how to use this specific technology called Vue.
Yeah.
Okay. You went to the guys and gals and the people who created Vue and you said, we want to help people understand Vue a little bit better. We have online courses that teach your technology. Can mm-hmm. we work with you to create this? And they're like, okay, right? So you walk through this arduous process, but yeah, you guys did this.
We probably spent like at least $10,000 worth of our time just creating this free video.
But you went to the source and yeah, then you created it in a way that helps them, pure benefit to them.
Yes.
Because the more people who understand how to use it mm-hmm. will use it.
Yeah.
And then you put this little, right in front of an audience, you put this little call to action. You could come learn this beautiful technology this way. And then you get them in your funnel, but it helps their funnel.
Right. Yeah. So they watch the video. It's at the end of it, it's like, hey, do you want to take our free course over on Vue Mastery? Click here. So they click on that free course. They play through and then they can start learning immediately.
Yeah.
They get to the end of the first video and it says, hey, congratulations, you got to the end of the first lesson. Don't forget to save your progress. You'll need to create an account to save your progress.
Boom, email.
Or, yeah, right. Or download our cheat sheet, you know, we'll do this. You know, if you sign up an account, we'll send you our cheat sheet. And then they get into the email, and then they get to the end of the first course. First course is completely free. At the end of the first course, it says, hey, you should come over to the second course. It's over here. And actually, the last lesson of the first course, at that point, we say, just create a free account and you can watch this last lesson and complete this course. So then at that point, they kind of have to create one.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, go take our real world course. And they go to the real world course and it starts out within the free video. But then, of course, you need to be a subscriber.
That's awesome. And so you created this partnership with the people who created the technology.
Yep.
You created a partnership with your product that helps their product get even better.
Yep.
And you also have this built-in like tool, this give back, mm-hmm. where as you get customers from them and with them, you recontribute to build out their technology. So the stronger that they get, the stronger you get, and it builds a great partnership.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I also think, you know, developers themselves like supporting open source. So I'm sure that's what increased our conversion by, well, if I had to guess, maybe 20% of just the developers that, oh, sweet. If I give these guys $100, I give $25 back to Vue. And that's important to give back like that. Or even like definitely the ones working for corporations to be like, dude, if my boss gets everybody accounts and we give them $1,000, that means our company is giving $250 back to the project itself, which yeah. Motivates developers.
That's pretty awesome, man. That's pretty cool. So Greg, where could people go to find more about you and about the project you're working on?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want a good example of how to set up online learning with this stuff, check out vuemastery.com, vuemastery.com. And also, if you like my style of teaching, you want to learn about all the lessons I learned the hard way, if you just Google Greg Pollack Founders Talks, I've got about 3 or 4 different Founders Talks that I created along the years, learning the stuff that I learned along the way, which would be helpful if you want to do online teaching in any which way or form. But then also I've got my blog. I've got some interesting articles up on my like personal blog at gregpollack.com. And also up on there, and this was the Choose Your Own Adventure. Also up on there, you can learn more about how to do equity right. Because, man, I've done equity wrong in the past. Did it pretty well with Code School, but I've done it wrong before that, you know, where you end up with a co-founder, you get 50%, and then the co-founder goes away, and you have to, like, dissolve the entire company because the co-founder and you aren't getting along anymore. I got to have that experience, which was the worst. And so there's this model called the dynamic equity split, which allows you to give people equity based on the amount of sweat they put in. And it changes over time, as it should. It's really genius. It comes from a book called Slicing Pie by Mark Moyer. And if you go on to gregpollack.com, you'll see a link to how to do equity right. I took his book, and what did I do? I created a video to explain it more effectively.
Yeah.
And then that's what I'm doing with the current startup with Viewmastery, is where we're using a dynamic equity split.
Nice. And you got a little grunt fund and as you're building this out. I think he actually came to Starter Studio to give a talk.
Yeah, he did. I didn't get to shake his hand. I think I couldn't make it that day.
Awesome. That's so cool, man. So Greg, man, this is really cool. Ladies and gentlemen listening in, if you want to connect with Greg, go learn from him about dynamic equity, which is so powerful, so important, especially as you're thinking about building a business. How do I slice that pie? If you want to learn more about that, go check out the explainer video, connect with him, and all those links will be in the show notes. So Greg, you'll just provide me with whatever you want me to toss in the show notes before.
And if you've listened this long and you're an entrepreneur, I want to make sure you know about Starter Studios Accelerator. Yeah. I think they're open for applications for the 11th class now. And so this is a 3-month accelerator where you get to be surrounded by other people building their startups, having the same issues that you are, doing the same sort of customer validation, which is really always like 50% of the value you get, just being around. But on top of that, we get all this programming. And I'm actually going to, for the next one, I got to line this up. I'm going to kick it off with this amazing 2-day organizational psychology communication workshop, which I love doing with people, that really is highly recommended. So hopefully starterstudio.com if you want to check that out. And maybe I'll see you there.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening in this long. And I hope you enjoyed being a part of this conversation. If there was a question that I just failed to ask and that you'd like to know more, I encourage you to reach out to Greg and his team and just learn more about what they're doing and ask the question that I didn't ask. Until the next episode, guys, I hope you enjoy this. Keep on building things and get out of your own way and let your heart build some really cool stuff according to the wisdom and advice passed through Greg. So hope you guys are having a wonderful day. Goodbye.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a good one.
See you.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.